The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Tonight is Family Night at the Free Library. Functional and not, mothers and daughters, fathers and sons. There's a lot to laugh and stew about, so let's turn to our guests. Dana Spiota is the author of five novels, including Wayward, which the New York Times called a virtuosic, singular, and very funny portrait of a woman seeking sanity and purpose in a world gone mad. Her other works include Innocence and Others, which won the St. Francis College Literary Prize and was shortlisted for the LA Times Book Prize, Stone Arabia, which was a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist, Eat the Document, which was a National Book Award finalist, and Lightning Field. Spiota was a Guggenheim Fellow, a New York Foundation for the Arts Fellow, and she won the 2008-2009 Rome Prize. In 2017, the American Academy of Arts and Letters awarded her the John Updike Prize in Literature. Described by the New Yorker as brash, extravagant, and chillingly beautiful, the novels of Joshua Ferris include Then We Came to the End, winner of the 2008 Penn Hemingway Award for Best First Novel, and a finalist for the National Book Award, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, which was shortlisted for the 2014 Man Booker Prize, and The Unnamed. One of the New Yorker's 20 under 40 writers, Ferris is also the author of the short story collection, The Dinner Party, which was his last time at the library. In A Calling for Charlie Barnes, the scheming and eponymous father finds redemption in perhaps the most unlikely and previously unimagined way. Dana and Josh, it's great to have you here. The screen is yours.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you for that introduction. So I think—
Hi,
Josh. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Good to sort
nice to
of
see you.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So I think what we're going to do tonight is, what are we going to do tonight?
We're going to read. Right. Do you want to start? We didn't talk about it.
Sure.
You wanted to start, or why don't you start? Because I don't even have my book handy. Hold on.
Okay.
Yeah,
so I have 2 5-minute readings. So I thought I will do both the readings, and then we can do questions, and then you do yours, and I'll do questions, ask you questions.
That's fine with me, yeah.
Okay. Or you can ask me questions whenever you want. Okay. So Wayward is about, takes place in 2017, and it's a woman in her early 50s, and she is going through a number of crises. She has found out that her mother is dying, that her she's going through menopause, and she's not reacting well to the inauguration of Donald Trump, and she blows her life up. She just falls in love with a house in the city and leaves her not so terrible marriage and her daughter, who's 17 and someone she's overly close with. And so that's the setup for the novel. And I'll read from a part where she is, this happens a little before she blows up her life. She's looking back on the sort of months leading up to it. And this is when she's working out with her trainer. Sweaty but now in the zone, Sam moved to landmine squats, the satisfying clank of adding plates to a barbell. Her muscles responded and got stronger, but it all still felt like a performance, a weightlifting cosplay for her own amusement. She laughed at herself as she grunted through the set, or did she do it to please Nico? Sam had started training with him a year earlier. Someone had told her about this miracle worker. He had devotees like a cult leader. It turned out that people, especially at certain points in their lives, just loved, craved being told exactly what to do. At the time, the feeling that she had lost her tether had just begun, and she still suspected it had something to be solved on the plane of the body. exercise or diet, or perhaps some renewing treatments that walked up to plastic surgery but technically didn't apply, microdermabrasion or pulsed laser treatments. Anything outpatient was still somehow a spa thing and not some woefully vain capitulation, not some hopeless and pathetic bid for lost youthfulness. Some of these processes had some plausible use besides vanity. They remediated some damage or such. The argument, although it wasn't thought out as much as it was a contagion among the women she knew, seemed to point to sex appeal, as the counter against midlife depression or confusion. Sam resisted the beauty treatments and the high-tech improvements. Sex wouldn't solve much, she knew, as she and Matt had always had satisfying sex, frequent sex. But the training registered something curious in her. It was Alicia, of course, Alicia, a fellow mother Sam's age with shockingly cut arms, had told her about Nico. Nico was 25 and in top shape. He was constantly on a cut or else he was on a bulk, but he always looked the same to her, young, perfect, ridiculous. And he talked constantly about body science and cutting edge workout theories. As she trained with him, their interactions so bodily intimate and yet almost entirely shallow, Sam developed a fascination for these bro science types, not the roidy bodybuilders, but the natural performance athletes like Nico. When she drove to her boring daily errands or just drove, she began listening to hardcore fitness podcasts in which one bro interviewed another. Walk me through your bulk protocol. Everyone was always walking you through something on these podcasts. She learned about slow regression, pyramid sets, flipping truck tires, body by science, seal fit, Wim Hof and warrior breathing, sledgehammers, log PT, rope climbs, wall ball throws, the benefits of hyperoxygenating or hypooxygenating, kettlebells, reverse pyramid sets, slow twitch versus fast twitch muscle fibers. Was it possible that inhabiting a human body was this complicated? She asked Nico at one point, more or less joking, but humor was lost on him. It is if you want to reach your highest potential, if you want to make real gains. What did she want? Did she want gains? Who didn't want gains over subtractions? Quantifiable, trackable, tape measure gains. There were the podcasts and then the YouTube videos, and Nico in real life, the in the flesh embodiment of a fully cultivated male body. Never before had she cared about these things. Her middle-aged fascination with these young, hyper-fit men was a mystery to her. It was not sexual, not at all, almost the opposite. She gawked at them in their robust narcissism. Wondrous beings who felt no shame in exhibiting their pure, their vain pursuit of perfection. In fact, they bragged about it. They weren't self-absorbed. They were optimizing. Not just looking better, they insisted, but improving lifespan, not just lifespan, but health span, which meant you looked and felt good. You became and remained a paragon human specimen. You attended the unquestioned goal of getting ever stronger, lowering body fat, building lean muscle mass, the daily hours in the gym, the measuring of dietary macros. Better look, better performance. But she wondered, better performance of what? Strength for what? Enhanced lifespan to do what? The precious treatment of your own lifespan, the obsessive yet superficial self-betterment, the fetishy focus on the body, the relentless and desperate pursuit of constant improvement. And although it might seem that strengthening meant no longer weakening and that pursuing gains stopped or even reversed the decline we all experience, this couldn't be true. Your body went in one direction, didn't it? It wound up and then slowly wound down. Her whack periods were a clear sign of the direction her body was taking. Maybe for men, it felt like less of an overt direction. But beyond the futility of body gains, what amazed her was their persistent insistence on boosting the self when the world, and this country in particular, was in disgraceful shambles, the progressing ever-widening gulf of disparity in every sphere. And were we not also on the verge of an environmental apocalypse? People seem more fixated than ever on notions of self-tend, self-care, self. In the current context, wasn't naked pursuit of health obscene? The self-contemplation down to the microbiomic makeup of your alimentary system, yet such contemplation was divorced from any reflection. This seemed, now more than ever, the most American of myopias, this unapologetic, boastful even, attention to the surface self. It sort of made sense, though, a retreat to the local, the hyper-local and controllable, your heart, your lungs, your flesh. Fecal transplants, stem cell injections, increased mitochondrial sensitivity. One set to failure, Nico said. Isn't that what we were all doing? One set to failure, she joked. But he just smiled and lifted his glorious, chiseled, unwavering chin at the barbell. Let's go, Sam. So that's Sam and her trainer. And okay, I'm going to read one other really short piece. So she moves to the city, leaves her daughter, and half the book, a third of the book is narrated from the daughter's point of view, and a third of it is narrated from Sam's point of view. Or I would say maybe two thirds of it. And then she falls in with this crowd in Syracuse. She lives in Syracuse, and she falls in with this crowd of they call themselves hardcore hags and harrigans, and they're this kind of middle age in your face group of people. And one of them, MH, is kind of got, you know, there's something up with her. We don't know quite what it is. She's probably not what she thinks she is, but Sam doesn't know how to read her quite yet. Okay, so this is pretty short. And I should say content warning for bodily fluids in this one. So a week after Sam moved to Highland, MH invited her and Lacey to the Smiley Face, the sad chain stand-up joint at Destiny Mall. Sam's move in the city seemed to signal some new trust, a closer embrace, even some potential at intimacy with Lacey and MH. Sam was no longer a suburban tourist, but the Smiley Face was not the setting for the sort of rad hangout Sam had imagined. MH had recently taken to going to open mics, to comedy clubs in particular, to test herself in the real world. I hate comedy clubs, hate the people who attend them, MH told her as they found a banquet table in the half-empty club. In a chain comedy club in central New York, this is some middle America shit right here. Sam looked around at the other customers. They did look like frat boys approaching 40. They had that bloaty, doughy look that men get in their 30s if they keep drinking beer the way they did in their 20s. So why do you come here? Sam asked. I come to stand up, MH said. Not funny stand up. I come to make them look at me, to make them see me, even if they boo me. And I come because I'm scared of it and I want to do what frightens me. It's her method, her philosophy, really, Lacey said. It's why she started the Hardcore Hags. Who says I started it? It's a secret group, MH said. Lacey smiled. Yeah, it is. MH turned to Sam. When I turned 50, I was divorced. My son was grown up and I realized I still had decades to go. It was the oddest thing. Just as the culture began to lose interest in me, just as the world decided I was irrelevant, I began to feel more myself than ever, louder, smarter, stronger. It felt truly adolescent, like I wanted to take drugs and drive fast and shave my head. MH ran her hand through the bristles on her head. I didn't want to be quiet and supportive. I didn't want to be dignified, and I didn't want to take care of anyone for a while. I wanted to be a little selfish, a little eccentric. She looked around the room. And once I hit 60, rather than mellowing, it intensified. I felt wildly unleashed. There's something about not pleasing people that interests me, about provoking people, about failing to meet expectations. It might be the abasement in it. I admit that. There's something revelatory and liberating about being an object of contempt. Sam looked back at Sam and held her gaze for a few seconds longer than Sam felt comfortable with. So Sam nodded and looked at something on the table. MH's blue, heavy-lidded eyes were set off from the glittering silver of her gray hair. Sam snuck a glance at her eyes again when MH wasn't looking back at her. The blue was so deep, it almost looked fake, like contacts, but that seemed unlikely. I like being grotesque, MH said. But MH wasn't grotesque, so like with so many MH comments, Sam didn't know how to take it. It occurred to Sam that they were the oldest people in the room. Really, the doughy men and their wives, the doughy men with other doughy men, and even a few college-age girls at one table. Yep, the oldest by 10 years or so. And all three of them with short hair and no makeup, they stood out already. Sam ordered a glass of wine, a sugary, thick, revolting Malbec. She sipped and grimaced. What? I think they added sugar to this wine, Sam said. Lacey and MH laughed. Wine, Lacey said, making air quotes with her fingers. You don't come to places like this and eat the food or order wine. It all comes out of a giant vacuum-packed Cisco bag of chicken breasts, including the wine, MH said. MH and Lacey were drinking whiskey on the rocks. Lacey ordered Sam a Maker's Mark, and then they were being quieted for the show. A local comedian warmed them up with jokes that amounted to, kids today, am I right? M.H. was the third to go on. Each person had 5 minutes. M.H. spoke in a low voice. Always a bit too confident and declarative, she now read as charismatic. Sam could see her clearly, and there was a shiny appeal to her on stage, broad but muscular, short-haired, makeup-free, yet glamorous in her way. Her jeans were cut narrowly and cuffed. She wore expensive motorcycle boots that folded back at the ankle. She didn't look like the itinerant that she apparently was. M.H. began her set with the story of getting her first period at 12. Quote, "The dictionary defines a period as a flow of blood and other material from the lining of the uterus lasting for several days and occurring in sexually mature women who are not pregnant at intervals about one lunar month until the onset of menopause." Let's follow that line. She then described her abortion at age 18, her pregnancy, her miscarriage, and her birth experience until she finally detailed her perimenopause and menopause. People sort of laughed in discomfort, but there were no jokes in there, not one. There was, however, a kind of arc, or at least an intensification to her set as she moved through time. M.H. then described her aging physical changes in clinical detail, the experience of discovering her post-menstrual body. "If you accept this new body," she said, "you have a period of freedom from fertility before you really begin to decline. It's an adjustment. Your waist thickens and your jawline softens. Your ass becomes both lumpy and flat. You chafe against the world. Yes, everything, everything becomes drier and rougher and worn down like sprung, stretched out elastic on a pair of granny panties." Her set had a clarifying effect on the room. People got up and left. Others conversed and ignored the stage. One guy, alone, naturally, stared at M.H. with a look of concentrated disgust. There was always going to be one guy who could meet the moment, bite on M.H.'s provocations. M.H. sat back down and looked over the room with a huge grin, apparently not just unfazed, but energized.
Nicely done. You know, those are two really nice passages to read because they're very representative of the book, I think, because you've got in that first passage this really searching, reaching, curious, sifting narrative voice that wants to kind of figure stuff out. What's going on here? What's this world? Who am I and where am I and why am I here? And this, the other passage is sort of, you know, more broad, it's more comedic, it's more outraged, but also sort of outrageous and fun and communal and her mixing up with other people. I wonder, I guess my first question is, what relationship is it that M.H. has with stand-up that Sam has with working out? They seem related.
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, I think it's partially trying to convince yourself that you can live with your body, I think, you know. Uh-huh. And I think in some ways MH's approach, and which I think Sam finds appealing, is just to kind of like double down on aging. But she's not really doing that. She's quite, you know, she looks bad at a certain point in the book. Sam said, yeah, she probably looks better now than she did when she was younger. She just has this kind of charismatic glow. She's almost like a cult leader or something. And and I think with Sam, she's going to the gym and she's critical of it, but I think it's so much her character that she questions herself, and she's attracted to people who don't question themselves as much. And I think she just has that kind of self-undermining where she kind of, and I think it's part of what makes her, I think it's part of her strength or her good qualities, is that she's trying not to be self-delusional, but yeah. That doesn't mean that she doesn't backslide all the time, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, self-delusions go a long way. They keep us engaged. They allow us to wake up in the morning. They're somewhat important. RH has a sense, though, it seems to me, that the answer is out there. The final threshold can be breached, and you can sort of enter into a transcendent world in which things are repaired and better. And I think what Sam insists on is that she's very skeptical about that. Transcendental realm. You know, she's asking all of the guys at the gym, what exactly is your ultimate aim here? She's sort of in the gym to sort of realign her serotonin levels, right? I mean, she was supposed to feel better. And she gets that. But there is this skepticism and this constant querying of the wider world. What's the ultimate purpose here? And I'm not sure Sam ever comes to it, but the other characters seem to have maybe at least some illusion of having the answer to that. You're very interested in this stuff.
But I think you get that kind of, as you say, if you start questioning, you know, I think it's midlife is a time when it's appropriate to sort of say, maybe I should question some of these assumptions. Maybe the status quo that I've sort of perpetuated is wrong or bad, or maybe I could do better. And you know, life is designed to kind of like sweep you along, right? And to not think about these questions. And I think when someone does stop and start doing that, it upsets the other people around you. And it also paralyzes
your life.
And it paralyzes you, I think, in some ways. And I think she has this, she's trying to figure out how to be and in an honest way. And that's maybe not really what humans can do. But I think there are moments where you can be that way. And those are kind of crucial for, I think, your integrity, that you have those moments. But she's, I think, in good faith doing what she's doing, you know, even though it has consequences that are maybe, and she backslides a lot. Yeah.
Well, she's trying to divest herself of those illusions that do seem connected to that monumental election. They seem like if things had gone the other way, I don't know that she would have gone out and, you know, burned her life to the ground, bought that house, left her husband, hooked up with, you know, some of these more subversive online groups and met them in real life, right? I mean, they're connected.
Yeah, no, I think it was definitely a big factor. And I think that she feels, you know, she goes to one of these resistance meetings and this younger couple, you know, sort of point the finger at the older women and they're outraged. Oh, we didn't vote for Donald Trump. But, you know, she's like, yeah, no, they're right. Like, we've been here for all this time. And, you know, and this has been here for all this time. And it's kind of on us, you know, that that the world is getting worse and not better. So I think she feels really implicated. And she feels like she's a colluder when she should do better. She's, you know, had been given a lot. And she's just, you know, sitting on her ass in the suburbs. And I think also, but menopause is a big part of it, because I think that it's like a, you know, a ringing bell that I think if you don't have menopausal symptoms, and not all people have menopausal symptoms, you have that slow decline and the menopausal symptoms waking you up in the middle of the night and remind you, yeah, you're going to die. You're like more than halfway through. This is it, you know? And yeah. I think, and then, you know, the sleep deprivation and the hormones unleashed various impulsive behaviors, perhaps.
Yeah. These are two pretty devastating blows that she gets back to back, because the political body is decaying and so is her private personal body, and she doesn't know what to do. And the only real answer to it, and it's really why the book is the book and why you start us off and give us this character at this moment in time, is because she's just trying, she's blowing it up. She doesn't have any choice but to question it all and burn it all to the ground. And then the story is really about how she will create for herself a life that's sustainable. I think one of the great things about the book is that it's presenting throughout these narrative possibilities, not only for the book itself, like the directions the book might take, but the directions that Sam's life might take to get out of these various avenues of despair. And you embrace some of them, you stress some of them, others you mute. And one of the fascinating things that I find that you mute is that promise of a kind of collective utopia or sisterhood or something that might have, you know, been in a lesser book, very soothing. And you don't do that. I wonder what the extent to which Sam is looking at these other women and the collectives that they're growing up skeptically.
Yeah, I mean, that might have been just a little bit of my own despair. I think, you know, some of the groups that she gets involved in sort of devolve and kind of eat themselves, and she doesn't feel, and people are not, you know, she's disappointed in who people turn out to be, that, you know, like MH. And I was kind of, I think it's because, you know, these things come up intuitively. It wasn't conscious that I was thinking that, but then I was also, it kind of tied into the Oneida part of it for me too, which is that there's a kind of, you know, you want to have this idealism and you want to believe in collective alternate possibilities. And I think all my books, I've been thinking about this a lot. It's very hard when you've been formed in a dysfunctional system to escape the terms of the system. It's like colonized you. And so then you end up kind of replicating it in another form on a smaller scale. And that sounds so bleak, but there's a part of the book that takes place at this real 19th century perfectionist community. And one of the characters in the book is this that you hear a lot about as a compromised woman's rights activist from the 19th century. Sam works in her house, her historical house, and she's, you know, problematic. You get to see her as a young idealistic person and, you know, really escaping the horrors of Victorian society to go live in this other place where you could have communal. And there's a lot of things about that really appeal to me, that you have, no private property, this kind of Bible communism. I mean, you can't argue against it. It's absolutely the better way to be, you know?
Yeah.
and why should, and what's the vanity of having exclusive romantic relationships? Why isn't everyone everyone's mom? Why isn't everyone everyone's wife? You know, like, why do we have these, why are we constantly drawing these lines between each other? But it doesn't work out as that easily, because, you know, so I'm trying to figure that out, Josh. You know, in the book, of course, you know, they have complex marriage in real life, the Oneida community, and they have this great, women have way more freedom than they do in the rest of the culture. They practice birth control, and they, sex is, you know, celebrating God and all this stuff. But, you know, you do have this kind of like creepy, I mean, I shouldn't say creepy, but he is creepy. You do have this male patriarchal leader who's the spiritual leader, and therefore the, you know, rules whatever he believes is true. And that's, it's, you know, authoritarian, and it's exploitative, and it's all the other things that ruin that perfection.
Yeah, the collective is just always being compromised, and the compromises are sometimes fatal, and you know, it doesn't pan out and you have to leave the collective. I mean, Sam does not find her solace in the collective, but, you know, if you have these darker things, you have something that is a counterpoint to that. And I find it incredibly moving and really warm. And that is that small group, and it's not always abiding. Here you have it tearing, things are tearing at it too, but that small abiding group of the family. I mean, her mother and her daughter. And then in the passage about the gym, the next passage, the next two pages, is this wonderfully joyous, emotional, very moving section in which a mother of a Down syndrome woman is bathing her in the gym, and they are enjoying each other's bodies and innocent, really. It calls her back to her daughter in this very to a more innocent time and a more simple time of being, just a way of being. And it's very beautiful, very moving. And I wonder, I mean, that's where, for Sam, that's where solace is to be found, is it not? In a sort of a small sisterhood.
I think the community that she does feel, that Sam does feel, this kind of idealism is the family. Yeah, I think she feels it with her mother and her daughter, to a certain extent her husband, but her mother and her daughter. And I do think it's the thing that's most meaningful to her. And that does, yeah, that's interesting. But you know what? I think it's time for you to read, Josh.
Is it?
It's like 8 o'clock.
Oh, my. Okay. Let me read.
But those were great questions. Thank you.
So I am going to read something about Charlie Barnes at the beginning of his, kind of at the beginning of his life, really. So this would be like 1956. And he was born to poverty, more or less, and born also, I think, with a fairly healthy libido. And so this is his first sort of a time out in the world. And yeah, I think that's enough. His career as a working stiff began, for all intents and purposes, on a night in October of 1956, when a young lady named Sue Starter walked by him at a high school football game as he was picking his nose in the middle of a dreamy youth. Against all odds, she found him fetching enough in his buzz cut and bib overalls to make a demand. "Buy me a Coke," she said. His reply was a dumb and startled look. "Who, me?" "What's the matter?" she asked him. "Don't you got any money?" Hell no, he didn't have any money. He had a curfew and a birthday, the sum total of his worldly possessions in 1956, and an indication of his sweeping power. At the sound of Sue's voice, he woke from his boyhood as if stepping through an interdimensional shimmer, dividing before from after, dreamer from damned, and vowed then and there to get a job. Before long, there were more demands just like it. "Buy me a milkshake, Charlie. Buy me a cheeseburger. Buy me those shoes in the window. Let's go to the dance, Charlie. Let's go to the movies. Let's go to the state fair." Let's have a closer look at Sue. Appearance-wise, Jerry's mother was a dark dream with full lips and almond eyes. Fashion-wise, she spared no expense, but looked as conservative as all the rest. In terms of morals, she was entirely conventional. In personality, a flirt; in outlook, a skeptic; in disposition, a bleak and dire depressive; in political mindset, more progressive than most; in matters of sex, boldly forward than discreetly withholding. If her kindness was subject to moods, she had her table's manners down cold, and her telephone etiquette was impeccable. Charlie knew as much because within a week of their first encounter, he had called her residence to let her know that he was bundling and delivering the Danville Commercial News for 4 bits a week plus tips. Would she like to go out on a date with him? He would not last long as a paperboy, 4 months by his current reckoning. At the time, it felt like an ice age, waking in the pre-dawn in the heart of winter, sick to his stomach from lack of sleep, pedaling through the freezing dark and wanting to die long before bundling the first of those morning editions. He started looking for a new job almost immediately. By the time he graduated from high school, he'd worked at a poultry farm, a lumber yard, the Lawhoff Grain Mill on North Avenue, and the refractory plant in Tilton, a 2-mile walk. Never a calling, though, these jobs. Thrilling at first, with the promise of more pay and future potential, they soon grew dull and proved short-lived, premised as they were on a simple exchange: my time for your money. Not even good money, really. 1 cent a bushel, 2 bits an hour, $3 a day. But what amounted to pocket change and gave him a taste of power ended up blinding Charlie for too long. False gold for closing on too much. A college education, for example, a law school degree, partnership at a law firm, pictured as a crystal decanter on a mahogany bar cart. or perhaps some steady climb up the corporate ladder, a place in the academy or in the halls of power. More damnably still, pocket change prevented him from seeking any ticket out of that dead-end town, as he was convinced he wanted what tethered him to Danville, a wife and child at age 19. Happily, he took jobs, quit jobs, got fired, walked into storage closets and meat lockers, forgetting what he came for, his mind always on some more palpable dream. Courtship, adults called it. It was necking to teenagers. Among sophisticates, lovemaking. To young Charlie, it was a barnyard urge, and it would determine entirely the first decade of his adult life. When he looked back on those lost years, he could only shake his head. Other boys managed to overcome it, moving with alacrity out of the barnyard into lecture halls, conference rooms, military bases, you name it, where instead of indulging the urge, you could tease out its marketing power or write treatises on its role in history, making real money in the process. Charlie kilned brick instead, hauled lumber, flipped burgers, made ballast, sluiced cow guts off tile walls, attached castings to chassis at the GM plant, coated fiberglass for TPAC, sorted jellied candies on a conveyor belt, and drove a truck for Fred Amond out of Hoopston before finally putting on a suit and tie to sell shoes for Mr. Joner, all in the name of keeping his young wife as happy as fate would allow so that he might continue to get laid. It was never all that happy. He was holding Jerry in his arms before work one morning, pointing out squirrels through the kitchen window, when she told him she hated her life. Hated him and the baby too. Jerry wasn't a year old. Then she confessed through tears that she was in love with someone else. Blew his fucking mind. Was anything real? I love Marshall, she kept saying. I don't love you, I love Marshall. Who the fuck was Marshall? Marshall Giacone, who ran the ball for Westville the year they took state. Charlie didn't stand a chance. He was devastated, angry, confused. If the phrase, buy me a Coke, had barged into a boyhood dream, permanently waking him to some greater reality, I'm in love with Marshall inaugurated him into the living nightmare that adult life could be. Deception, shattered dreams, the heavy burdens of parenthood, and Charlie Barnes at 20, still secretly a boy himself. I'm in love with Marshall should have spelled the end of his union with Sue Starter, but it dragged on another 10 years. 10 more years. So then some years transpire. They divorce. He marries a second woman. They divorce. And then he marries a third. Almost immediately, oh, that woman's name is Charlie too, just so you know. Almost immediately, they had a hard time getting by on two state salaries. The economy wasn't so great in 1974. There were fuel shortages and sudden price hikes. The house on Vermilion came with a stiff monthly mortgage. He was 50 years old and in need of repair. His Newport kept breaking down, which was a happier fate than the engine fire that put her Pinto out of commission on the corner of Logan and Clay. They survived with only one car for the rest of the year until the following April, in fact, when they got a little back in taxes just in time for the roof to cave in. He hated living paycheck to paycheck, hated the chipped tableware they put out for guests, the threadbare towels on the bathroom hooks, the mismatched bed linens, the secondhand furniture, the stains in the carpet in every room. And yet, what was the cause of this unaccountable happiness? From the beginning, there was a quality to their lovemaking that resisted the old associations and terms. It had been a barnyard urge. So what exactly was this? Among his kin, those country bumpkins, and as a young boy running around tin shacks, and later even as a man among men on sales floors, he came to know the crudest, vilest expressions for what a man did to a woman. Often enough, in those few words and phrases, the woman did not so much as even factor in. Some penetrating violence was aimed at a void, and the man was pleasured. That was the sum of the sex act and how the world taught Charlie to regard it. With Charlie Prophet, though, he began to think for himself. That sort of talk was not just ugly, but inaccurate, as disrespectful as it was dead wrong. He had no words for what he and Charlie did. By some physical process, rooted, he supposed, in the same old bodies he'd always had, its senses, receptors, instincts, the pulse quickening as before, the identical perspiring skin and dilating pupils, the endorphins coursing through self-same veins. He locked eyes with that woman and entered a trance, unlike any before it, entraining their heartbeats, rhythms, blood flow, their animal bodies becoming one, and pure transcendent devotion took hold. It was predicated on stuff outside the bedroom, her work with kids, her convictions, how she stalked a first baseline during softball games. It was a martyring, unmanning, dispossessing devotion. All that folktale and matinee movie stuff he confused for entertainment turned out to be true to life, for this was as close as he'd come to a hero's tale and storybook romance, even as the house came crumbling down around their garden.
That's great. Thank you. You know, I love this book. And I have to say that it's kind of a miracle, your book. And I really don't, it's a miraculous book. And I don't quite understand how you pulled it off, that you have this kind of self-reflexive, formally playful, like really playful. And it's also just a heartbreaking, warm, just really soulful novel. And the two parts that you read kind of are also related, how you manage to do this tone where you can really make fun of Charlie and really very funny in this kind of farce, this kind of satirical mode. And yet at the same time, we really feel him, we're really rooting for him. And by the time you get to that relationship with his wife, Charlie, we really want it, he deserves a fucking break, you know? And and you're so happy that he gets it for a while. So how do you manage to do this kind of, and there's a kind of like earnest sort of heartfeltness in that depiction of love that you just described, what love, real love, and mixed with this kind of irony that we got in the first section. And so tell me how you pull off doing that at the same time.
I think for so long, it was the book and my approach to it was very monotonic or monochromatic, in part because, you know, it goes without saying that there's a vast gulf that separates the character of Charlie Barnes from my father. But when I did start the book, I was just writing about my dad, and I was trying to memorialize this guy that was dear to me. And as you well know, and I'm sure you've seen 1,000 student writers founder on this, as well as experienced writers, the memorializing impulse is maybe the most difficult to deal with, because you're trying to capture something from life that means a great deal. And the result on the page is a paltry, pale imitation of that felt experience. So, you know, so very frequently I tell people that I'm not really convinced that write what you know is the right way of going about it, because it really sets up this extraordinary, real barrier to entry, because everything that you put in there is going to kind of pale. And in fact, it did for me for a long time. And so it was that sort of like one note, basically grief, you know, that kind of, I was writing grief in its way, almost automatic writing. Like it didn't look like fiction.
You were trying to really just describe your father on the page as he was. Were you writing a novel about him, or were you going to write a memoir about him?
I had kind of decided not to know. Just decided to, you know, I mean, you know, many things you probably do in life, you do as a writer, because you're a writer, you know, so maybe you grieve as a writer, maybe you figure out what the hell the world is as a writer. I mean, I see you in Wayward really reaching, like trying to figure out this world. And, you know, that's what I did. I just sat down and So yeah, to some extent, I was really just trying to resuscitate him, you know, in an act of grief. And at a certain point, I got the humor back. And I was like, I don't know that I'm grieving anymore, you know? And I don't know that I'm just, I thought, well, sure, maybe I have it in me to write just a great memoir, like a straightforward, like, this is the shit. And at the end, we're all cry. Well, I'll be crying too. But it didn't pan out. You know, I kind of discovered that the writer that I am has to come at it in this comedic vein. But what that allows me to do is to break it and to be less monotonic.
Yeah.
You know, also, so.
Yeah, go ahead.
At that point, I'm just dealing with different tones, you know, I'm dealing with different, so that I can get, weirdly, you know, get as much life in there as I possibly can. I've moved on from trying to memorialize life, and I'm trying to imitate it.
But there's, yes, but there's also just like a foundational affection for this character that we can feel even when he's made ridiculous or he makes himself ridiculous. It feels like that there's always just this humanity that's kind of that keeps him and that gives the reader, I think, hope that he's going to redeem himself eventually. And I think that's so interesting, the irony of that too, because I think he's such a victim of this kind of American dream. You know, it breaks my heart. My dad was like this too, that this, you know, this kind of like this idea of a calling, but really it's about just like, you know, this very narrow idea of what a successful man is.
Yeah.
And men of that generation, I don't know, your dad was probably same generation as my dad. My dad was born in 36. I don't know.
Yeah, 39.
Yeah. And I think it was very, it was a different world. And, you know, they were supposed to have the world on the string, right? And they did have everything. But at the same time, you know, the scrabbling for money that you described and just the kind of hard terms of capitalism, it's just corrosive to their possibilities. They can't even, they're not looking for their calling. They're just looking for this other thing, right?
Yeah, I think they confuse it for aggrandizement too often. You know, it was, I mean, two things were incredibly instructive, and that is the extent to which my father, the real man, was really tender and really, I would show up, he would pick me up for Thanksgiving, and the first thing we'd have to do is like drop off 5 turkeys to people on the South Side. Like, where that came from, I don't know. But, you know, and he was a foster kid, or a foster parent. Very late in life, he fostered a kid who ended up breaking into his house and like destroying it. So he was a very generous man, and he was incredibly generous to me and the other important members of his family. He was a nurturer, really. I mean, what he essentially was a caregiver, somebody who could help you see what you knew to do and make it happen, help you make it happen. And it was he had a genius for this, but that larger culture refused to permit a man to be such a thing very easily. You had to buck the system. You really had to have a strong character that I don't think he really acquired the man himself until much later in life. The other very instructive thing for me was the way in which my mother saw him after the divorce, which was as a kind of farce, frankly. And I start this section off by calling it farce because I think it was easy to look in on men of that generation and this man in particular and see only the things that made them jokes and made them less than satisfying men. And it just happens to comport with my idea of the way in which we greet strangers. We don't see them fully. We might even just pick up on some facial feature or personality trait or tick or something like that and run with it until something happens and we plunge further into their psyches and their souls and we get to know them better. And then suddenly those farcical elements just start to fade and the real person rises up. And that's how I see my interactions with other human beings. I have to fight the urge just to categorize them as various farces. I have to fight it. And I think that's what I wanted you to experience here. I wanted you to see this man in full, start with the comedic, start with the broad and the farcical, and then hopefully end with something more substantive.
Yeah, because we're always looking, we're always sort of putting people in categories and typing them and making stereotypes and cliches of them, and you really avoid that completely. But I want to ask you about this this book. I don't want to give anything away, but it is, I mean, I don't think it's giving away much to say that it has in the middle of the book, it labels itself as it starts out as farce, and there's a little middle section, and then there's fiction, right? So and then there's a coda, and I want to hear about, and there's so many flips and layers, and there's this epigraph. Now, this Jeanette Walls epigraph from The Glass Castle that you've appropriated for your book. Tell me about that. Is that just a signal to us to just like watch out for trickery? What is that doing there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's fascinating when you read a memoir, you almost always now, it's sort of pro forma. First, I've consolidated events. I changed the timeline. Characters are composite. And I'm thinking, well, that's what I do, buddy. You know, we've been doing this for years. Like, what is this false categorical difference between the novels we're writing and the memoirs we're writing? Those really collapsed for me after the 100 millionth qualifier like that. And then also pro forma is the one that says in the middle of the memoir, of course, this was just my perspective. Everybody has their own story. And then, you know, now that that's been detonated, you can proceed to basically tell everyone in no uncertain terms exactly what happened. And from an objective point of view. And I thought, well, that the qualifier isn't really holding water anymore. The Jeanette Walls thing was interesting because at the end of that, you get the sense, okay, she's thanking her siblings. You know, thank you so much for this. Thank you. So I'm so happy that you helped me. You really saw what I saw in the book. And then the last one is like, I'll always love you. You know, to my last and not least sibling, I'll always love you. And you're like, there's a whole novel there. There's a whole novel in the differences that this book has created between the author and this person that she's thanking in this rather distant way compared to the one that she thinks at the very beginning. And I just thought, this is my novel. This has got to be the novel. It's got to be about that unspoken drama.
Yeah. And in the second half of the novel, when the more, metafictional elements kick in and the self-referential stuff really kicks in, you kind of enact this kind of writer's nightmare where all the characters in your book are telling you all the things you got wrong and how offended they are by what you did. And it becomes, I mean, it's still very funny. It becomes more complicated. But I was thinking that isn't that impulse to be, I mean, you know, I'm a fiction writer, you're a fiction writer, so we're biased in that direction. But there's something very honest about sort of saying, being self-referential and drawing attention to the artifice, because it is artifice. And if a reader can enjoy it while also remembering that it's artifice, that does feel like I don't know if this is a pure value or anything, a more honest place to exist.
I think so. You're right. We are biased, but I think so. I think the other thing there is a limit to the extent to which a memoirist, I think, at least I've noticed this constraint. There's a limit to the extent to which they can endow the other characters with certain illusions, the fictions that they themselves carry forth into the world. By which they live, by which they find meaning in life, even though they may not exist. The everyday fictions that we need to wake up in the morning and just proceed.
Right.
And I think that's what sort of gets lost in what a novel does so brilliantly. It shows us these conflicting illusions and delusions and the shattering impossible way of reconciliation of them. And the memoir, I find I tend to think it's a little, weirdly, it's a little bit more tidier, you know? And I think the novel's got to come in there and slop it down a little bit.
Okay,
we'll probably so run another time. Huh?
Okay.
Yeah.
There are some questions for you, Joshua. Joshua, who is on your t-shirt?
Joshua's on a t-shirt. This is Camus. Camus. I'll show you, he's smoking. Isn't that cool?
That is cool. That is cool. I do have another question for you. Were you thinking about kind of like a Penin kind of with this narrator, sort of the eye encroaching more and more and then becoming a character in the book? Was that one of your models, or what were your models for this book, if there were any? I mean, it seems singular. I don't know, the most original thing, but.
Yeah, Penin, you nailed it. That was a good model because it, you know, there's even a moment in Penin where he names himself. Nabokov names himself, which, you know, is, I find, like, even now, 70 years later, he's like on this autofiction. He knew everything. He did everything.
He
even did autofiction, you know?
And
I find that moment, they're it's Penin and his old buddy, and they're in a lake or a little pond, and they're bathing in the pond, and a butterfly comes in. And,
of course.
Yeah. And he says, oh, if what's his name was here, you know, if Vladimir was here, he'd tell us what the names of those beauties are. And Penin is like, I always thought that was a big, you know, facade of his, that he knew the names. He goes, oh, no, absolutely not. And then he just moves on.
Right.
And I find it so moving. I don't know why, but I find it really, that moment really moving, because he just announces himself. And he also admits where he gets Penin wrong and where he gets him too broad. And so I find it just a very honest approach to another human being.
He's much crueler to Penin than you are to Charlie.
He is crueler. That's true. Yeah.
But I think there's also that you have that Pale Fire thing too, where you have that kind of, you know, you can read the book one way and then it slowly has to be read twice, I guess, is what you'd say to get it.
He was a touchstone for sure. I mean, I don't know that, you know, I mean, he's a tough guy to follow. He's a tough act to follow. So I'm not sure what I did, but I tried to do it. And it was really the only way I knew how to treat my father's life with respect.
No, it's all fiction. It feels like a very beautiful tribute to him, because it feels, you feel all the love and in it, but you're not just making him, you're not just rendering him into a character. You're kind of like getting the whole, I don't know, it's really nice. And I like in the book that in real life, your father really did live for a while with his cancer, right? And it wasn't,
he got diagnosed.
He did redeem himself and have a good life, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he had 7 years with pancreatic cancer, which is very rare, you know, and in that time, he, you know, just to tell a little anecdote, when he called me and he said he had pancreatic cancer, and he had said to me that day, he's crying, he's weeping on the phone, I've always been afraid of having pancreatic cancer. And I didn't know anything about it. Like, this was one of his like chronic fears. Like, he had this as a young kid, maybe he knew somebody or something, I don't know. But for years, he carries around this fear. He gets it. He calls me. He's devastated. He's 68 years old. He's at a loss. He hasn't done everything he wants. And it's a shit show, because he feels fine, more or less.
Right.
7 years later, he calls me. He says, I have bad news and I have good news. The good news was some minor thing, like the bladder infection is cleared up or whatever. Bad news is the cancer's back and I have about 3 months to live. Dry eye. He says, you know, I'm going to miss you. But that was it. He had done so much in that 7 years. So I got to see this remarkable ascent out of so many of the concerns that he had into something far more noble and beautiful. And at the end, yeah, it's true that cancer had taught him how to part from the world. but he was ready to go in other ways, in other important ways. And it is definitely, if I'm thinking about the illusions by which I live, it's that, because it was really moving to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So is a fiction in the book that's called a novel, does that make it the truth?
Yeah. I mean, that's where I don't really understand this book either. Like I get really confused, because in fact, that's the truth.
It is the truth.
That's what happened.
Right.
And no, so
I had
to really work very hard to understand what the hell I was doing when I was doing that, because it didn't come naturally to me. You know, I had to like invert a lot of things and play with them. And at that point, like, I'm definitely leaving real life behind, but at the same time, it's all predicated on real life.
Right. The lie that tells the truth.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. And I thought, you know, I used to think that was something of a cop-out or half-truth or something, but now I'm like, yeah, if it's not fiction, it's not real.
Well, it's what George Saunders was saying about, you know, Lincoln and the Bardo, that like those formal things that feel like somebody's like, oh, I have this great idea, blah, blah. It really, they work when they come out, when they're out of necessity. Like there's just no other way to do it unless you do this, invent this formal thing to this apparatus that can make it work. And you found this apparatus that allowed you to tell the truth, you know, this truth, not the superficial facts, you know?
Yeah.
So, and that's exciting. And I think that's why it feels like a living thing when you're reading it. It feels like something's happening, you know? We have some questions or no?
No, we're at time. I hate to see it end, but.
Oh yeah, there we go, okay.
Time. It's just the truth. It was a wonderful discussion. Thanks so much. And to the people at home, you can click on the chat and get the book through Uncle Bobby's Bookstore. Josh, Dana, thanks so much.
Thank you, Andy.
See you in Philly for the next one.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you, Dana.
Everybody, and
it was
thanks,
great
Josh.
Great talking to you. Thanks for everybody
on
coming.
Your amazing book. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.